All right, we continue 2,000 Years of Jewish Odyssey, Part 19, the 19th century, sponsored again by Becky Navi Katz, Le'ili Nishmas, Yona Ben Rabbi Le, Tenishmaso, Sruro, Vitzor HaChayim. As we move into the 19th century, we necessarily become more superficial. There are probably 10 events and at least 10 personalities that deserve their own hour, for two reasons. The amount of material is, of course, voluminous. It's within our historical memory. And especially because the 20th century was largely shaped by the trends of the 19th, so that our lives today, what happened in the last 100 years, were still actively responsive to the events, currents, and challenges of the 19th century, of which there were many. You recall from last time, Moses Mendelssohn, whatever his intentions, paved the way for two tragic developments in the 19th century, one of which has paved or changed Jewish life until today. The first was the alarming tendency of Jews in the generation after him to convert to Christianity. Without facing the traditional threats and intimidation that had always characterized medieval conversions, Moses Mendelssohn, in a sense, koshered Christianity by watering down Judaism, by universalizing it, by finding the common ground between Judaism and Christianity, by demanding that Jews be full and equal citizens, that we're not really that all different from Christians, except in ritual. And that ensured that Jews indeed would not be much different at all from Christians, except in ritual, which they could easily abandon. Four of Mendelssohn's six children converted to Christianity, and within just a few decades after his death, conversion to Christianity among German Jews became the rage. So the first decade of the 19th century, 10% of German Jews converted outright to Christianity without any real coercion, gaining for themselves immediately the rights and privileges of Christians, university admission, professorships, other employment possibilities, but never fully escaping the so-called stigma of being Jews, Germany after all being Germany. In the 19th century, an astounding 250,000 Jews across Europe converted to Christianity, not because they admired the ideology, but mainly because they desired the economic opportunities. They'd long since abandoned the pretense of Jewish observance and Torah study, renounced the uniqueness of Judaism, and our covenant with God. So except for socially, it wasn't that great a stretch for West European Jews to convert, and for many, not even socially. Famous figures, Benjamin Disraeli became the Prime Minister of England. His parents converted. He converted as a child. Heinrich Heine, the German poet, the universally acclaimed poet, was another famous convert who hated Jews and Judaism, and he really defined the process. He said conversion is, quote, the entrance ticket to European society. Now, this was also facilitated by the other movement to which Moses Mendelssohn indirectly gave birth, and that's Reform Judaism, one of the trends in Jewish life that we'll discuss that would change a century and beyond. But even Reform Judaism requires some background to place it in its true context. There were many movements, many trends, some of which carried over from the 18th to the 19th century that we have to discuss. The 18th century had seen the development of a new trend in Europe, Western Europe, that would have global ramifications. The Enlightenment would engender the recognition of individual rights and liberties, of a natural law of human beings that superseded religious or theocratic law, the right of people to self-government, and the belief that reason and science could provide man with better guides to good conduct than religion. Undoubtedly, the Declaration of Independence, the U.S. Constitution, the French Declaration of the Rights of Man, and other constitution-type documents of the era were all Enlightenment products, by and large. Now, the Enlightenment had a particularly Jewish form, known as the Haskalah, its proponents, the Maskilim, to which we'll return. But at its core, the Enlightenment was not Jewish. It was a worldwide movement that did change the world. One byproduct of the Enlightenment did have immediate repercussions for Jews, and that was the movement for emancipation. Mendelssohn had already written about the fundamental morality implicit in making Jews equal citizens in society, and Western Europe, to an extent, always to an extent, was receptive to this at a price. Best illustrated in a comment by one of the leaders of the French Revolution, who said in 1789, the Jews should be denied everything as a nation, but granted everything as individuals. That is to say, he said it, there cannot be a nation within a nation. Should Jews want to be equal citizens, they have to lose their parochialism, they have to lose their allegiances to some other people outside of their host country. So with emancipation, truth is, even before it, the issue arose that would become known in our world today as dual loyalty. Or put another way, can Jews ever be completely loyal to a foreign nation? In every country where emancipation became a possibility, many non-Jews objected on that very basis, that Jews would always have an allegiance to another nation than their host country. In fact, that undercurrent still exists in America today. You see it in the fevered swamps of Jew haters. Nonetheless, Jews were voted equal rights as citizens in France in 1791. Ghettos were torn down in France after Napoleon's early conquests in parts of Italy as well. In fact, in Italy, after it became a state in the mid-century, Jews were emancipated. And many Jews took an active role in the French Revolution itself. And in fact, a wave of patriotism, Jews entering politics and national life, swept through England in the 19th century and even parts of Germany. These advances were not always welcome, and opposition grew among both the intelligentsia and the peasantry. Voltaire, the French philosopher and thinker, who never actually said, "I disapprove of what you say, but I'll defend to the death your right to say it," he harbored those sentiments, but he never actually said that. Voltaire viewed Jews and Judaism with contempt, undisguised contempt, Christians too. And that was fairly typical, because however approached, Judaism was tied to the old world of religion and tradition from which enlightened man was trying to escape. Jews found that the challenges of equality were as grave as the challenges of inequality as emancipation greased the wheels of assimilation. And it turned out, sadly and very quickly, that the enmity of the non-Jewish world had been a leading cause in keeping Jews Jewish. And once that dissipated, Jews abandoned Judaism in large numbers. The tension was obvious when Napoleon in 1806 convened what he called an assembly of Jewish notables from across France and the Rhineland to formalize the relationship between France and what he called French citizens of the Mosaic faith. And the tension was even more patent when Napoleon in 1807, a year later, convened what he called a Grand Sanhedrin. 71 Rabbonim from across France to answer 12 questions about the propriety of Jews as citizens. Questions relating to marriage. Can a Jew marry a Christian? And if not, why not? Does Jewish law demand that Jews only marry Jews? And what does that mean if you're a citizen of a country and you can't marry another citizen? Are French non-Jews to be considered brethren or strangers, according to Jews? Would Jews fight for France? Consider it their country. To that the Rabbonim answered, to the death they would fight for France. Do Jews take interest when they make loans? do they distinguish between Jews and non-Jews? So these questions are obviously loaded questions. To some extent, we're still answering them today in every society in which we live, including Israel, and the Grand Sanhedrin, these 71 Rabbanim led by Rav David Finkelstein, fudged many of their written responses, downplaying the Jews' commitment to the land of Israel, saying that intermarriages, note the precise language, intermarriages are not binding under Jewish law, but recognized under French law, minimizing the horror as if it's just a question of record keeping, and they outright lied and said, no, there's no distinction between Jews and non-Jews when it comes to charging interest. Religious Jews, the few in France and elsewhere in Europe, lost respect for the so-called Sanhedrin. Secular Jews saw it as a license to become even more French than Jewish. If you think about it, the country that produced the Baalei Tosfos in the 12th and 13th centuries has not produced a world-class Gadol in maybe half a millennium. I can't think of even one. Not great Rabbanim, but a world-class Rav that other countries, Jews in other countries, turn to. I can't think of one French rabbi who fits that category. And many non-Jews perceive the Sanhedrin as a cabal of Jews, igniting fears, never dormant, that Jews were secretly plotting to take over the world. This, of course, did not help. Emancipation, long an aspiration of Jews, was decidedly a mixed blessing, and only had its full measure of success in the United States, whose Bill of Rights in 1791 proscribed Congress from establishing a state religion, and whose third president, Thomas Jefferson, wrote openly in 1802 of the Constitution creating what he said was a wall of separation between church and state. So even though there were legal limitations on Jews in certain localities from the start of independence through a good part of the 19th century, these were countercultural and over time all faded as well. You know American history, Catholics also face sometimes the discrimination. So subtle discrimination remained, but was almost never backed or defended by the government. And that made all the difference between America and Europe. Mendelssohn's influence was felt in another development that would change Jewish life until today. Israel Jacobson, 1768, 1828, can be considered one of the fathers of Reform Judaism. He was born into money, the only child of a wealthy German family, married into more money. He was an avid reader of Mendelssohn, went to university, was a dilettante who fancied himself an educator. Jacobson, in 1801, built a school in the Harz Mountains for an elementary school for Christian and Jewish children who would be educated together, free of charge, meaning at his expense, in an atmosphere of pluralism. So this naturally led to his construction in 1810 of what he called a temple on school premises, in which he placed an organ and introduced prayers in German, and with that, Reformed Judaism was off to the races. It was egalitarian, mixed pews. He, Jacobson, eliminated references to Mashiach, eliminated the covering of the head, the observance of Shabbos and Kashrus, and daily prayer, and a movement took root, sweeping through Germany. For the most part, it was a reaction not so much to the religious establishment they rejected, but to the outright conversions to Christianity that were taking place. In other words, Reform Judaism started to prevent a mass exodus to Christianity, rather than as a rebellion necessarily against Torah. That rebellion had already taken place decades before. Nevertheless, Reform Judaism became a way station on the road to conversion, as families rarely sustained their spiritual needs as Reform Jews. Even today, we're hard-pressed to find three or four generation families of Reform Jews. Either convert, or more likely today, they intermarry and just drop out. Reformed Judaism also reflected the fact that Protestantism was gaining ground and strength in Western Europe, where most of the converts in Germany became Protestants, not Catholics. So Reformed Judaism, in many respects, patterned themselves after the Protestants, a religion that could embrace the modern world, unencumbered by religious doctrines and the rituals of ancient times. So it was tailor-made for people who wanted some religion, but not too many restrictions. And it attracted an audience. The sermons, for example, in the temple in Berlin were so good that the Protestant pastors came to listen. Maybe half a good word on Shabbos, they could use themselves on Sunday. Reformed Judaism became less and less Jewish with the Hamburg prayer book, the first Siddur they published in 1819, eliminating all references to Yerushalayim and Mashiach and the Mikdash and Karbanos, etc. Another leader of Reform, Abraham Geiger, 1810-1874, rejected the concept of the Am HaNivchar, the chosen people, and of Revelation itself. Reformed Judaism, thinking about it, becoming the first Jewish group, so-called Jewish group, ever to deny Maimed Har Sinai. All the rebellious individuals and groups dating to the time of Korach until the 19th century, either Karaites, the early Christians, whoever it was, never denied Sinai, that God revealed himself and gave us the Torah, until the Reform movement in the 19th century. Interestingly, Geiger's doctorate at the University of Bonn traced the Quran in large part to the Talmud. He said it was essentially a plagiarism of the Talmud. And he himself, although opposing Mila and Shabbos, he did not seek to ban Mila, nor did he seek to move Shabbos to Sunday. That would come a little later in the 19th century with Samuel Holdheim in Berlin, who also abolished the Yarmulke and the Talis and Shofar and Hebrew, and the notion that Jews were a nation altogether, to be apart, to be considered different than others. And he, of course, was the one who moved Shabbos to from Saturday to Sunday. But it's important to note that the Reform as a modern movement had little internal discipline. It's really the same today. Once the notion of an absolute authority is discounted, then each person, certainly each rabbi, becomes his own authority. So the deviations of Reform Judaism did differ somewhat from place to place, but all united by rejection of the Talmud, rejection of the divinity of the Torah, the divine origin of the Torah, and an embrace of modern secular values of primary importance, superseding anything the Torah had to offer. Within decades, the most German Jews had embraced Reform Judaism, an overwhelming majority. This had a direct effect on American Jewry as well, as the first large-scale immigration of Ashkenazim were German Jews in mid-century, and they brought and implanted Reform Judaism on these shores. And it's been an uphill struggle ever since, and really the battle has been joined since then. Famous Reform leader of the last half of the century, Isaac Meir Wise, founded the Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati and hosted the first graduation, the first ordination of Reform rabbis in America in 1883 at what became infamous as the Treif Banquet, known until today as the Treif Banquet at Hebrew Union College, at which clams, crab, shrimp salad, and frog's legs in cream were served as the main dishes to show their contempt for kashrus. Not very appetizing, whatever, however you feel about kashrus. Reformed Jews also became famous merchants and traders, well-known figures. Lazarus Strauss founded A&S and Macy's. Levi Strauss, mid-century, created the jeans. Gimbel's, Sears Roebuck, they're all German Jewish immigrants. Occasionally, this caused trouble. In 1862, in the middle of the Civil War, General Ulysses S. Grant, later a president, expel Jews from the Tennessee Territory for illegal trading, war profiteering. Jews had come to Tennessee to buy Southern cotton at very cheap rates, take it to the North to sell at higher prices, and he had banned that. They did it anyway, so he expelled the Jews from the Tennessee Territory en masse. Within 24 hours, all Jews had to leave. Only time Jews were ever expelled from part of the United States. But Grant's order was quickly revoked by President Lincoln, who at first didn't even believe that Grant would sign such an order, but in fact, within weeks, it was revoked. Lincoln, by the way, also appointed during the Civil War the very first Jewish army chaplains. The third trend related conceptually to the first two, and that was the Jewish Haskalah. Haskalah endeavored to make Judaism more palatable to the non-Jewish world by displaying our intellectual attractions. Famous reformist and Maskil Leopold Zuns, 1794 to 1886, one of the founders of the Society for the Wissenschaft des Judentums, the study of the science of Judaism, to record and promulgate the cultural contributions of Judaism to the world so they better appreciate us, and to examine scientifically Judaism, stripping it completely of its divine basis and of its spirit. The society itself, founded in the 1810s, quickly disintegrated when many of its members converted outright to Christianity, but Zuns persevered, and his movement became known as Chochmat Yisrael, the wisdom of Israel, to be distinguished from and opposed to the Torah. Notable figures in the Chochmat Yisrael movement were the rabbi-hating historian Heinrich Gretz, who wrote a comprehensive but very biased history of the Jewish people, and an observant Jew, Rav Zacharia Frankel, who founded a rabbinical seminary in Breslau dedicated to propagating his ideas, a sort of more traditional Reform Judaism, but in which he himself hedged on the divine origin of the Torah Shebaal Peh. In that sense, Frankel is a forebear of conservative Judaism, which is really an early 20th century, late 19th century American product, who've also always hedged their positions on these matters. The Haskalah, as we know it, was a byproduct of the scientific Judaism movement, and it infiltrated even Eastern Europe. Note, until now, everything's been in Western Europe, but Haskalah came to Eastern Europe during Napoleon's conquests. The big machlokes amongst Jews in Eastern Europe how to relate to Napoleon, to support, to help, to oppose, to thwart. The Alter Rebbe of Lubavitch famously opposed Napoleon, even urging his Hasidim to become spies against France. How a Hasid can infiltrate the French army, it's hard to figure out. But he feared the cultural onslaught that Napoleon would bring that would lead Jews away from Torah. Other Hasidic rebellion felt that Napoleon's wars were Chevlei Mashiach, and since he was more kindly disposed to Jews, they felt some good would come out of it. In the end, the Alter Rebbe was right. As the Haskalah came and sought to emphasize Jewish culture over observance, focusing on history, literature, the embrace of non-Jewish culture, especially language, and importantly, broadening the curriculum of Jewish schools so we wouldn't learn only Torah. It's very hard for us to relate to the dangers that the Rabbanim felt towards the Haskalah, because we, 200 years later, 180 years later, have become much more open to secular culture and less fearful, despite its continuing allures and assimilation here. We feel that modern Orthodox Jews have succeeded in keeping the wheat and throwing out the chaff. I'm not so sure modern Orthodox Jews are as successful as they think they are. But nonetheless, that's the goal. That's the objective. To opponents of Haskalah, even reading secular literature became taboo, and even learning the language, whether Russian or German, was dangerous. And in fact, in that milieu, it was. It was widely held that exposure to non-Jewish cultural trends would sweep Jews away from Torah. And strange as it sounds, they were right. It often did, sad to say, because for most Jews, knowledge of Torah was a mile wide and an inch deep. And it simply did not penetrate Jews to the extent that they'd be able to withstand any onslaught. The self-styled maskilim did not help, as their writings ridiculed the rabbis, and they often enlisted the support of the Tsar to help them infiltrate the school systems where they did not already dominate, and vice versa. We'll see the Tsar reached out to them as well. Many gedolim of the last century, I mentioned a few weeks ago, Rav Aaron Cutler, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, they were the only one of their siblings to remain frum. And temptation was great. And I suspect that opposition to college among many gedolim in the last century stems from their fear of Haskalah. One theory underwrote all these trends, enlightenment, Haskalah, the emancipation, reform, is the goal of mitzvos was to create an ethical person, and a person could be ethical without it, so why have mitzvahs? Why be different? If all mankind could pursue ethical greatness, so then why be so parochial? In fact, that's not the purpose of mitzvahs. The question, the premise was wrong, but there was one great miscalculation of all these movements. They felt that these would somehow reverse the pervasive Jew hatred of the non-Jewish world and usher in a world of freedom and prosperity for Jews and for all mankind. And in that, they were dead wrong wherever they were. Everywhere they were dead wrong across Europe. Their lingering influence, Maskilim, is not in the openness of America, because here the religious climate was different, it was more tolerant. But in the late 19th century, disappointed by the continued rejection of the non-Jewish world, many Maskilim turned to Zionism pre-Herzl as the new movement that would save Jews. In so doing, we'll see this next time, they tainted Zionism for many religious Jews, and their names endure, if only on Israeli streets. Rehov Mapu, Rehov Lilienblum, Rehov Gordon, etc., the Maskilim who became Zionists in the 19th century. Almost every trend that we've discussed so far, whether the Haskalah and Reform and others as well, every trend in the rabbinic and Torah world in the 19th century was a response to one of these other movements. In the short term, the antagonism of Hasidim and Misnagdim subsided. The 19th century was the heyday of Hasidus, Sanz and Kutsk and Rizhin and Babov, etc. But there were more pressing common enemies than simply fighting over the things that had so exercised everyone in the 18th century. And there were both immediate and long-lasting responses. The first was the founding of what became known as the yeshiva movement. Jewish education had been informal for centuries. Young Jews were given a rudimentary education. Gifted students went to learn with the local rav or with one of the gedolei hador. That's how Europe existed. There were yeshivas, but nothing was really formalized. That all changed in 1803 when Reb Chaim Volozhin, 1749 to 1821, opened the yeshiva Eitz Chaim in Volozhin, a departure from the past. This was the Eim HaYeshivot, the mother of all yeshivos, a yeshiva with a dormitory, with a curriculum, with students drawn from across the world, meaning it was seen as a global, not a local institution, supported by Jewish communities, who we visited by Mishulachim, they're still coming, and soliciting money from Jews across Europe, even later on from America as well, to support these yeshivas. Volozhin was an elite institution that revolutionized Torah education. It abandoned Pilpul. It implemented a rigorous, logical study of the Talmud that would engage the sharpest minds and train the leaders of Israel. And in fact, that did happen. The Litvish Derech, which it spawned in learning, not only shapes our methods of Talmud Torah until today, but it countered the Reform scientific Haskalah notion that there was no real intellectual depth to Torah. One who understands the way yeshivas learned in the 19th century, and even certainly when Reb Chaim came along, could not possibly maintain that there's no intellectual substance to Torah. The Velashen Yeshiva in its original incarnation closed in 1892 and was led by, after the Reb Chaim's death, his son Reb Itzel of Velashen, for a time Reb Yosher Ber Soloveitchik, the Beis Halevi, his son Reb Chaim was Koresh Yeshiva for a decade. In the 1880s, Reb Chaim pioneered and sharpened, refined the Lipkische Derech, renamed the Brisker Derech, but Velazhen is most associated because for the better part of 40 years, the Rosh Yeshiva was the Netziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. Very soon after Velazhen, other yeshivos opened. In Mir in 1815, later in the 1860s in Slobodka, which is a suburb of Kovno, in Raden, where the Chafetz Chaim and Yisrael Meir Kagan came, in Telz, and dozens of others. These small towns, and almost all of them were small towns, yeshivos were never in cities, became legends. Known across the Jewish world, their incarnations endure in Israel and America today, and children competed across Europe for admission to one of these prestigious yeshivos. Many of the gedolim of the 19th century became distinguished, renowned, for their battles against Reform Judaism. For example, the Chassam Sofer, Reb Moshe Schreiber of Presburg, today Bratislava, the capital of Slovakia, 1762 to 1839. He started yeshiva in Presburg soon after Velazhen as well. He was born in Frankfurt, a student of Reb Nosson Adler, himself later moved to London. The Chassam Sofer was a tireless and fearless warrior against Reform Judaism, coining the phrase that really defined his era, Chadash Asur Min HaTorah, borrowed, of course, from the halacha of Chadash, of Tzuah, that is permissible only after only the first day of Pesach. Chadash Asur Min HaTorah is a phrase that caused harm as well, that the new is always forbidden. If the new is always forbidden, then life and Torah stagnates. But nonetheless, much of Hungarian Jewry is based on that premise, and much of Orthodox life was based on that, for all the good and some harm that it did. Chassam Sofer is a great posek, whose yeshiva produced the leaders of Hungarian Jewry in the 19th century. His sons, also the Maram Shik, or Moshe Shik, but other giants fought reform. Rabbi Akiva Eger, tremendous gaonus we don't really appreciate. Rabbi Yaakov Etlinger, the Aruch Lener, Rabbi Yaakov of Lisa, the Bala Nesivos, Rabbi Shamshon Rafael Hirsch, they were relentless in their opposition and their outspokenness at great personal cost. Rabbi Hirsch wrote his first book in German, The 19 Letters, designed to appeal to German youth, to show them both the relevance and profundity of Torah. And then he wrote the Chorei for adults. We give it out to our B'nai Mitzvah in Shul. Just a summary of the mitzvos of what Jewish life is all about to appeal to them. Rav Hirsch bears special mention for a number of reasons. 1808 to 1888, especially for his lasting impact. Rav Hirsch was a champion of a movement that he called Torah im Derech Eretz, Torah with the way of the world, that sought to encourage Jews to participate in world affairs. Rav Hirsch himself was a member of parliament in Moravia for many years until he moved to Frankfurt to be involved in the public domain while retaining one's Torah commitments. In 1851, Rav Hirsch was invited by a bare minion of Shomer Shabbos families to come to revitalize the Jewish life in the city of Frankfurt that had become a Reform bastion. And Rav Hirsch did so, even years later supporting against some of his colleagues an ausstritt, a separation from the official Jewish community of Frankfurt so as not to formally recognize Reform at all. Rav Hirsch did more, and in the dominant written intellectual offerings of the 19th century, he and several others wrote commentaries on the Torah and Tanakh that had dual purposes. First, to show the unity of the written and oral Torah, to counteract Reform and Frankl's Derech, how the former The written Torah, Torah Shebichtav, is incomprehensible without the latter, and how in fact both are divine. The Torah given on Sinai was given in a written form and an oral form to Moshe. That was the prime goal of Hirsch's commentary on Chumash, of the Netziv's commentary on Chumash, Amek Dover, of Aksava Kabbalah, of Rav Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg, as well as the stupendous commentary on Tanakh of Rav Meir Leibush Weiser, 1809 to 1879, known to us as the Malbim. That those who maintain that the Malbim was a Gaon on the level of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, if not greater, but because he chose to write on Tanakh, which was either a masculine interest at the time, or today in the yeshivas they say it's what the women learn Tanakh while the men learn Gemara, because he didn't focus on Gemara, but rather wrote an extensive and profound commentary on Tanakh, he did not receive the same acclaim in the yeshiva world that Rav Chaim did. But the Malbim was at one time the chief rabbi of Romania. He lost that position, then another position, when Reform Jews harassed him over his Torah loyalties and appealed to the authorities. That was one goal, to show the Reform and those with those inclinations that the Torah itself was a unity. There was a second purpose to these commentaries, to counteract another pernicious development in the 19th century, the origins of biblical criticism. This was a German non-Jewish theory that in one form, in many different forms, but in one form alleged that the Torah was not divine, Rahman al-Islam, but the confused product of a number of different authors, usually four over various centuries, who couldn't keep God's name straight and who did a poor job of editing the book. What became known as the documentary hypothesis of a German professor, Julius Wellhausen, was as much an attack on Christianity as on Judaism. But only in recent years have we learned that the propagators of the documentary hypothesis and much of biblical criticism were outright Jew haters who sought to strip Judaism of its uniqueness by stripping the Torah of its divinity. The saddest aspect of this was the Jewish support it attracted amongst the reformers, amongst the maskilim, and still maintained today, especially in academia, read Hebrew University. But it's been mostly discredited to in large measure to these commentaries, which showed for all the infinite wisdom contained in the Torah, but partly due to the exposure of the corrupt motivations of the originators of these theories. Granted, it's still breathing and fuels much apikorsis to today as well. There's another response to the anti-Torah trends in the 19th century, and that was the Musar movement, founded by Rabbi Yisrael Lipkin of Salant, Rabbi Yisrael Salant, 1810 to 1883. He was a student foremost of Rabbi Zundel Salanter, from whom he learned the fundamentals of Musar that he made into a coherent and cohesive movement. And individuals striving for ethical perfection should be at the top tier of his endeavors in life. Through studying and internalizing classics like the Chovos HaLevavos, the Mesilas Yesharim, to take a character trait, for example, and study it, and study the human personality to understand the psychological roots of our thoughts and deeds. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter preached the value of Musar study in its own right, and set up Musar Batei Medrash, and trained a cadre of disciples who would both follow his path and carve new ones as well. Reb Simcha Zissel Ziv, Reb Naftali Amsterdam, Reb Yitzhak Blaser, Itzla Petterberger, with major Musar centers in Kovna and Kelm and Novardik and Slobodka. Ironically, because Reb Yisrael was critical of the establishment, the Maskilim originally saw him as an ally, even trying to have him appointed the Rosh Yeshiva of their government-sponsored Vilna Rabbinical Seminary, but they soon learned that Rabbi Yisrael was an arch foe. Double irony, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was also opposed by much of the yeshiva world. Many yeshivas refused to allow the introduction of Musar, maintaining, perhaps too optimistically, that Musar was unnecessary of yeshiva students. They got it from learning Gemara. You be the judge whether it's necessary. In many yeshivas, especially after the 1870s, actual fights, even fist fights, with chairs and shtenders flying in the yeshivas over how and whether Musa will be introduced. Some would say the very idea that they're throwing chairs at each other in the Beis Medrash would seem to indicate that Musa has a role, but that was lost on many of the protagonists. So in fact, the yeshivos had to contend with Musar, with Haskalah, with scientific Judaism, and two other forces as well. It was quite a momentous century. The famous Zohar that became popular in the 19th century on a pasuk in Bereishis and Vayera, in the Zohar, it's Kuf Yud Zayin and Parshas Vayera. Uvashis Meo Shnin L'shtitno, in the 600th year of the 7th century, the 6th century rather, Yispatchun tare de chachmasa le'elo umabue de chachmasa le'tato. The gates of wisdom from above would open along with the wellsprings of wisdom below. The gates and wellsprings of wisdom did burst open after that year, the year 6600, the year 1840, and the world was changed, not always for the better, by the contributions primarily of three Jews. Sigmund Freud transformed the study of the human personality, not always in healthy ways, but he transformed it. As Albert Einstein, a little later, would transform the study of the universe, as another individual, another product of parents who converted to Christianity, transformed the political order, and that, of course, is Karl Marx. 1818 to 1883. He was a German grandson of a rabbi, converted with his family to Lutheranism at age 5. He became a rabid hater of religion generally. Marx posited that a world of equality and brotherhood would only arise through an end to capitalism, to be brought about by a class struggle that would see the oppressed workers of the world unite to overthrow their masters and seize the means of production for themselves. Hasn't quite worked out the way he hoped, but the notion of universal peace through equality and justice struck a chord with Jews. Many held, many still hold, l'tov u'l'ra, that only a Jew could have devised such a system that Marx did. Many Jews were swept away by his movement, Marxist, socialists, communists, and towards the latter part of the century became involved in various revolutionary activities in Europe. Really the first time in all of the exile that Jews became actively involved in movements to overthrow the political order. But the influence of the socialist ethos lingered in Jewish life, really until today, and found its audience. Strange as it sounds, it found its audience even yeshivas. Yeshivas had to contend with socialist cells, with the force that pulled people away from Torah to a world of ostensibly universal brotherhood. That, along with another powerful force that also pulled in two ways, and that's Jewish nationalism, Zionism. Nationalism swept through Europe in mid-century, and Jews were caught up in it as well. Asking the question for the first time, as Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer did, Rav in Poland, who wrote the Sefer Drishat Zion in 1862, a scathing criticism of Jews, saying, are we inferior to Italians? Just a few years earlier, Italy had broken away, overthrown most of the papal states, become independent. So are Jews inferior to Italians? And we have the most glorious and holiest land. So why can't we do what the Italians did, what the Serbians are trying to do, what nations across Europe are trying to do? or if Kalisha followed without knowing the writings of Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai 2 decades earlier, a Serbian Rav who called for the first time for the purchase of land in Eretz Yisrael by Jews and the settlement of Jews there and the development of a homeland for Jews. This idea found a secular audience with a publication in 1862 of a book called Rome and Jerusalem by Moses Hess, and then in another work called Auto-Emancipation, meaning Emancipating the Self, by Leo Pimsker, also a famous street name in Israel, in 1881, which began what was known as political Zionism, the practical quest for a homeland for Jews. To be accurate, the term Zionism actually came into use in 1893 from a Jew named Nathan Birnbaum, who, strange as it sounds, always irony in life, he eventually became an anti-Zionist. He made up the term, but he became an Agudist, especially in response to the overly secular nature of political Zionism. That movement, that quest, received a boost in the 1870s from a movement called Chibat Zion. The participants were Chovevei Zion, lovers of Zion, which won the support of many Rabbonim across Europe, including the Netziv. And yet even the Netziv strongly opposed the chapter of Chibat Zion. The Netziv opposed the forming of a chapter in Volozhin of Chibat Zion because of Bittul Torah. Nonetheless, in Volozhin, to mention a few months ago, was really a hotbed of activity. A clandestine Zionist cell existed anyway. Just another current sweeping through the yeshivos and the Jewish world. During the 19th century, Jews began returning to Israel, and again, long before Herzl. We noted last time the Talmidim of the Gra, the Gaon Mivilna, settled in Tzfat and Yerushalayim. Not only that, but also by the force of their personality, were able to establish their customs as normative, such that Ashkenazic Israel, until today, generally follows the Minhagei HaGra, especially in Tefillah. Two great figures underwrote Jewish settlement in Israel. Of course, the Rothschild family bears special mention. Meir Amschel Rothschild, his son Nathan, amongst others, were investors, textile merchants, bankers. Truth be told, they were war profiteers as well. They made a lot of money on Europe's wars, bankrolling both sides. The family soon dominated banking in Europe with sons and therefore branches in every European capital. Their descendant, Baron Edmund Rothschild, poured money, a lot of money, $60 million in 19th century money, into Jewish settlement in the land of Israel, into towns, wineries, Rishon LeZion, Zichron Yaakov, he named after his own father, founded in 1882, Baron Rothschild, known until today simply as Hanadiv, the benefactor. Another benefactor was Moses Montefiore, lived a long life, 1784 to 1885, 101 years, the wealthy and prominent banker and religious Jew, became a world-renowned philanthropist, also buying land in Israel, establishing the first communities outside the Old City in the 1850s. Mishkanot HaShananim, Lady Yamin Moshe, named after him. Keep in mind, this counteracts some of the mythology of the Arabs, by 1840, Herzl was not born yet for 20 years. By 1840, Jews were already a majority in Yerushalayim, 8,000 Jews in a population of 15,000. Montefiore had a number of projects across the land of Israel, built a dome over Kever Rachel that we no longer see today, and of course the famous windmill that became a source of income for Jews. Montefiore also became involved in two infamous anti-Jewish incidents in the mid-19th century. The Damascus blood libel in 1840, in which Jews, Damascus, were accused of ritual murder by Christians. Dozens of Jewish children were then kidnapped and held by the authorities. They were freed upon Montefiore's intervention with the Sultan of Turkey, and for the very first time, an American president, Martin Van Buren, the 8th president, sent a letter of protest through America's consul in Damascus to the governor of Damascus, asking that the Jews be freed. So that crisis ended well. The second did not end as well. In 1858, a young Italian boy, 6-7 years old, Edgardo Mortara, was kidnapped from his home in Bologna by the papal police and sent to live in a convent on the grounds that once while he was ill, his parents' maid had baptized him. She took a cup of water from the sink, poured it over his head, and he was therefore, according to church doctrine, a Catholic. Worldwide protests were to no avail. A similar case had happened in Ferrara 40 years earlier. Pope Pius IX said his hands were tied. That's the law. When Mortara became of age, 18, he became a priest. Also lived a long life. Think about it, he was born in 1851. He died right after the Nazis invaded Belgium. He was living then in a monastery in Belgium in 1940. For his, I guess, dedication to Catholic doctrine, Pope Pius IX was beatified by John Paul II a little over 10 years ago. All of these swirling currents in Europe, the yeshivos and the musar and askola and Zionism and socialism and the Enlightenment, the emancipation, all of this took place against the backdrop of what was in Eastern Europe under the reign of the Tsars, a reign of cruelty and brutality that was medieval. In Russia, in Eastern Europe, there was no enlightenment, there was no emancipation, there was no reform, only continuation of the policy of deprivation, of pogroms, a terrible pogrom in Odessa in 1871, and attempted forced conversions of the five Romanov czars of the 19th century. Even the one or two with liberal tendencies were stifled by the clergy and the nobility. The policy towards Jews in Russia in the 19th century was summarized once by the minister in charge of the Jewish question, Konstantin Podonetsov, who said he would solve the Jewish problem through one-third conversion, one-third emigration, and one-third starvation, and all were tried. Two examples suffice. The infamous Cantonist decrees of Nicholas I, what a reign of terror, 30 years, 1825 to 1855, in which he decreed that each Jewish town had to provide a quota of Jewish children at the age of 12, taken away, for 6 years of military training, followed by 25 years of service in the Russian army. Do the math. They wouldn't return to their homes, if they would return at all, until their early 40s. And there was a quota that had to be met. Often the children of the poor were snatched to substitute for the children of the wealthy, pitting in many towns Jew against Jew, with Rabbonim often helpless in the middle. Brave Jews, some Rabbonim as well, hid children. Some parents mutilated their children, cutting off their trigger fingers, for example, to be of no use, could not be drafted. Some communities hired choppers who would kidnap children in order to meet the quota of the Tsar. Most of these children, and there were thousands, most never came back. And of those who did, the vast majority were no longer Jews, having been subject in their decades to sermons, maltreatment, and forced conversions as well. Nicholas I also ordered that other Jewish children attend state schools where they could be indoctrinated with Christianity. He heavily censored Jewish publishing. A lot of Sfarim we have still today bear the stamp of the Tsarist authorities, approved by the censor. He banned at various times Jewish dress. And then he did try to enlist the Maskilim, willing conspirators, to remodel Jewish education, even opening government schools and rabbinical seminaries, even ordaining rabbis, that rabbi being called the Rav Mitam, sarcastically, the Rav from the government. Of course, the 19th century saw its share of riots and pogroms in Germany, the infamous Hep Hep riots in 1819 that took Jewish life and whose details were suppressed by the Maskilim, who assumed that the new world order, the new improved world order, was just ahead. In Greece, even in Meshed, in Persia, where Jews were forced to convert to Islam, dozens were killed in riots when they refused. Germany was so vociferous in its Jew hatred that a so-called League of Anti-Semites was created along with the term itself. Sounds very genteel, anti-Semitism, by Wilhelm Marr in 1879 to combat the excessive influence of Jews in German life. The League of Anti-Semites. The second major event was the pogroms of 1881 after the assassination of the Tsar Alexander I, for which Jews were falsely blamed. Tens of thousands of Jews across Russia were attacked and hounded, ruined economically. Some were killed as well. Two immediate consequences, all related to the loss of hope that conditions would ever improve. Firstly, after these pogroms, 1881, a wave of emigration to America began to escape the barbarism of Russia, such that in the ensuing 40 years, 2.5 million Jews left Eastern Europe, came to America, completely dwarfing, in many cases antagonizing, the existing Jewish population. And secondly, as I noted earlier, even the Maskilim lost hope that Jews would ever be accepted, and many turned to Zionism, catalyzing the first Aliyah, the so-called first Aliyah of the 1880s. It was right after the pogroms in 1881 that Pinsker wrote his Auto-Emancipation. Even in Western Europe, Jews began to realize that discrimination would never end, even where governments no longer endorsed it. A Viennese journalist, Theodor Herzl, born in Budapest in 1860, lived a short life, died 1904, at the age of 44. In the 1880s, he had endorsed conversion to Christianity as the only solution to the Jewish problem. Even he came to believe that that would not work, that even converted Jews would still be persecuted. He came to believe that only a Jewish state would end Jew hatred by normalizing the Jewish people. That hasn't quite worked out either. He too despaired of any progress in Europe as a witness to the trial of Alfred Dreyfus, the French army captain who was framed for passing military secrets to the Germans. Dreyfus was convicted in 1894, sentenced to prison amid the jeers of the mob, and when the real culprit was identified several years later, exposed by the journalist Emile Zola, the Jew hatred in France was such that Dreyfus was tried again and convicted again, notwithstanding the fact that someone else had been identified and was still alive as the perpetrator. Dreyfus eventually was pardoned in 1906, and the Tom that he was, he re-entered the French army, was promoted to major, and in fact he fought bravely in World War I. I think he was even gassed, was injured at the front. In any event, soon after the Dreyfus trial in 1896, Herzl wrote his first famous book, Der Judenstaat, The Jewish State, the framework for what a modern Jewish socialist state would look like. And in 1897, after a year of frenetic activity, he convened the first Zionist conference in Basel, Switzerland, with 197 delegates from 16 countries. And there he wrote in his diary that, he said, there they founded the Jewish state, which he felt would be created within 50 years. He was right. But in those 50 years, Jews would deal again with all the repercussions of the movements of the 19th century, the reform, the Haskalah, the twin threats of assimilation and persecution, the growth and challenges to both Torah and Zionism in new locales, and with unprecedented devastation, but also responding with inspiring courage, commitment, and faith. All that next time when we look at the 20th century. I thank you all very much.